doing, looking at that structure and thinking this is going to hit Mach 3?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, it would not hit Mach 3 unless you folded the wings up, because if you know a bit about aerodynamics, you know that the faster you go, the less wing you're really going to need to maintain the flow. So to get the kind of speeds they wanted out of that airplane, they basically needed to retract the wing. And so the solution was to fold that wing up and change its incident angle so that it really was not effective.
Well, that had to be quite a ride. Did you ever get to see the Valkyrie fly?
I never saw one fly, because when the company... So I was there, and I don't remember the exact date of the cancellation of the project for production airplanes. I'm going to guess it was early 1962, maybe.
It was in the early 60s, as I recall. I can't remember.
I'm going to guess like May or June of 1962, and a guy came by my desk and said, Raj, I hate to tell you this, but they just canceled the contract, and you're out of here. We're not paying you beyond lunchtime today. So pack up your stuff, you know. And as you may recall, the way those companies billed the government was based on the hours put in. So everybody had a time card. You put a time card in, you know, and based on your rate, that's what got charged the government plus the overhead. Mm-hmm. So once they couldn't charge the government anymore, we were out the door. So I started thinking about another job, but then they called me back. About 2 weeks later, before I could even find another job, they called me back, and so I continued to work there. But that convinced me that I probably ought to find a different profession, and so I moved away from aeronautical engineering. I had just got, in that June, I just got my master's in aeronautical engineering at UCLA, and lo and behold, that was the last I saw of an aeronautical job for about 5-6 years.
So when you were working on the Valkyrie project, did you actually ever get hands-on with the airplane?
Well, I got into we went out to Palmdale a number of times and worked on the construction site. So we were actually out there, you know, with the airplane, taking a look at the stuff that we were doing on paper. My particular area of responsibility was the splitter and the first part of the ducts and the ramps. And in the ducts were these ramps, and it's a little hard to explain, but they're on the inside of the duct between the two left and right ducts, and they expanded towards the outer walls, kind of like I'm demonstrating with my hands and my fingers here and my knuckles.
Well, what it did
go
was,
outward.
It looks like you're describing the narrowing of the engine duct.
Right, and initially the pilots controlled that because they didn't have the – they hadn't worked up the algorithms to really – detect how to keep the shockwave in front of those engines. But we did some calculations, or actually I didn't personally do them, but one of my friends did some calculations. And at Mach 3, at any altitude, you got about a 400 to 500 degree temperature rise across that shockwave. So if you're down at low altitude, that means the incoming, the inlet temperature to those GE engines, to those compressors, was in the order of 600 degrees Fahrenheit. And needless to say, you know, that is getting pretty hot.
Yeah, that would definitely affect the engine performance. And not only that, but to a degree, I imagine the structural strength of the aircraft, too.
Yes, we never actually had to worry too much about the structural strength of the splitter and the ramps and the ductwork, because we had designed it already to take up to around 1,700-1,800, and our calculations and the measurements showed that we never got anything over about 1,100-1,200 in flight. So basically, most of the key structural stuff was well below its critical temperature.
So when you were out there at Palmdale, did you get to actually meet any of the pilots that flew the Valkyrie?
Well, you know, we met them, but back at LAX, back in the corporate offices, when you go out to Palmdale to work on stuff, you basically walk into the shops, you know, and the pilots are in some other area. So we really – I have met a couple of guys – but in different environments. One was Scott Crossfield. I don't know. That name is pretty familiar to most people who know North American.
Right. Well, not only that, but he was also the first man to break this twice the speed of sound.
Yes, yes. And he also had a couple of other interesting accidents at one time or another. I don't know if you remember the X-15 one time had an accident.
Right.
And Scott was the guy running the throttles when that accident happened.
Yeah, there was some kind of problem he had with the airplane. He broke her back on landing, basically.
No, it was actually on the test stand when it blew up.
Okay.
It was bolted to the test stand. So the back of the airplane was bolted to the test stand, mm-hmm. and we were running. You know, we just got the old motors out of there, the little motors, and we got the big motor in there. And the big motor still, we questioned a little bit the business of throttling it back to 50% versus, you know, full 100% power. And after we finally got done tracking exactly what happened, the pump that pumped the hydrogen peroxide cracked. A crack occurred in that pump. And so the explosion started at the pump, ran up the hydrogen peroxide line, hit the hydrogen peroxide bottle, and that's what blew up that big bottle in the middle of the X-15 and split it in half. The back half stayed on the test stand, and Scott Crossfield shot forward about 100 feet.
Wow.
And so when he jumped out of the airplane, he thought he'd had a heck of a ride.
Oh, he did. That had to have been a pretty good bang.
Yes, he got a big bang out of
that one. Oh, I'm sure he did.
He laughed about it afterwards.
Oh, I met Scott Crossfield. He was a good guy.
Yeah.
I liked him.
Yeah, yeah. He was In life, my son ran into him, and my son had heard me talk about a few of the X-15 stories because I enjoyed working on that airplane a lot. And in that particular time, you know, he was one of the people that was involved in getting the ejection seat into the thing so the guys could actually, at lower altitudes, could get out of it. Because remember, the original X-15 did not have a Martin Baker ejection seat in it. So we finally put a Martin Baker ejection seat in it, and he was key person behind getting that thing in there.
I can understand him wanting to have a way out of it in case of a problem.
Yeah, you can't get out of that thing, you know. But once you get down, you know, below 30,000 feet, you can slow it down enough you can get out.
Yeah, the X-15, I think, hit like Mach 5. I keep thinking 5 or 6, but I think it went faster than that. There was a time when they really pushed her.
I don't remember the top speed on the X-15 anymore. I'm not sure that anyone ever knew what it was, but at one time, I think more people made astronaut in the X-15 than made it in Mercury capsules.
Yeah, that's right, because they were right on the verge of space. As a matter of fact, wasn't the X-15 used for control systems testing that eventually led to spaceflight?
Oh, absolutely. It had little bitty rocket motors in the nose. And so when the pilot was sitting there fooling around, you know, above 70 or 90,000 feet, something like that, those rocket motors kicked in, and that's what steered the airplane, not the aerodynamic controls on the wings and tail.
Well, if you're up above a certain altitude, you have basically not enough air to run the control surfaces.
Right. The airplane wouldn't respond. But, of course, with those little rocket motors in there, it worked great. And if you notice, I don't know if you've been around the shuttle, but boy, it's got big ones in there.
I haven't been around the shuttle that much. I look forward to it, though.
Yeah.
Well, it's a much bigger ship, too.
Right. So a lot of that technology was first put into play right there. And near as I can tell, nobody got the... A couple of people, I think, got close to instability with the X-15, but nobody actually did wind up in a tumble. I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure nobody tumbled it.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. Now, the B-70, you know, on the other hand, the B-70 had a few aerodynamic problems of its own right.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And they fixed those problems on the number 2 ship, for one thing. They added dihedral to it. Well, they put more in it, I read.
Right. And at the time, we did a little bit. We did about a week's worth of work on the Canard. I don't know if you remember much about the Kennard design, but the Kennard grew, and we put an active control system on the Kennard, and the Kennard's really kind of what saved that airplane to, you know, make it flyable. Without that larger Kennard, it was too tough. You could get it into a nose-up attitude, and you couldn't recover it.
Ooh, that would have been very, very bad with that airplane.
Right. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting story about Concorde and that. I don't know if we should bring that up in this conversation.
But we've been talking about X-planes and supersonic stuff. Why not?
Well, after I eventually went back into the aviation industry, I taught aeronautical engineering at Imperial College from 1972 to 77. And there was an old German aerodynamicist there who had spent a lot of time working on Concorde. And his name will come to me. Concorde also had a ton of problems with stability. And as you know, that wing is very complex with different sections in different areas and guides, vanes to guide flow around, and, you know, a very complex aerodynamic problem to get that airplane to you know, be stable at low speeds. And so Kukeman, that was his name, Kuchemann. He was the German aerodynamicist, came over from Germany at the end of the war and was worked at Farnborough. And after retiring out of Farnborough, where most of that work was done on Concorde, he went to work, taught at Imperial. And so as a new young professor there, I sat in on his classes because they were just fascinating.
Right. Sounds like a good time. Roger, yeah. There was a very tragic event involving Air Vehicle Number 2 with the XB-70. They had a mid-air collision with an F-104, and of the three pilots on board the aircraft, two were lost. What was the mood at North American when the crash happened?
Well, I was gone, but I got immediate phone calls to tell me. And I can tell you that it was pretty shocking to a lot of the people. When we had that B-70 in the wind tunnel, we had that in the low-speed tunnel a lot. And in the low-speed tunnel, we measured some of those vortices that are coming off that airplane. You know, you had to land that airplane really at a pretty low weight. So if you had excess fuel on board, you had to dump it before you landed it. So you need to land that airplane pretty light. And because you get it down at that low speed, you know, when it's heavy, the vortices are really large. So we knew that at low speeds where they were trying to take those pictures, you know, they were trying to photograph the airplane. That right. was a photographic mission that they were flying with that pilot.
They surrounded the XB-70 with, I think, four or five other aircraft, and every one of them was powered by a General Electric jet engine.
I didn't know that, but what I do remember is we knew that the size of those vortices were enormous. And we also had criteria set up at some point. I wish I could recall exactly how we did the pilot training. I don't recall. I remember scanning at some of that stuff one time. But, you know, when you're working there, you don't get a chance to read other people's stuff all that much. But most pilots who were working with that project knew that that airplane generated some very monstrous vortices at those. So you get the thing into that nose up attitude, you know, you're flying at 225, 250 knots. You know, you got the nose up pretty high there. That thing is generating there's a lot of power. Those engines are up close to maximum power. You know, those six engines in the back are running close to maximum power at that low speed and that high angle of attack like that. And so those guys were generating some monster vortices, and once that guy got too close, it was impossible for him to recover. He couldn't have got out of it if he wanted to.